Good day, and welcome to the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Director Phil Keith. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Shelby, and good afternoon, and thank you for joining us today. I call the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice to order. And on behalf of Attorney General Barr, we thank you for joining us today for this important Commission teleconferencing meeting. This week's series of teleconference will be focused on law enforcement recruitment, training, and retention. As mentioned last week, we're on track to continue this schedule of conference calls with 3 calls per week through the week of June the 15th, and we're continuing to explore an in-person commission meeting the week of June the 22nd. As most of you know, this is Police Week. This is a time where, as a country, we come together and honor those brave men and women in law enforcement that have lost their lives, and we pray for their families. We also recognize the tremendous sacrifices that law enforcement makes for us every day. We're typically together this time of the year, sharing memories and stories and honoring our protectors and that have made the ultimate sacrifice. But the impact of the COVID-19 has removed us from that opportunity to a virtual environment. All of us recall the informative and compelling testimony we heard in Miami this past February on officer safety and wellness, and now we're seeing the continuation of felonious acts of violence against the men and women that served so bravely, as well as dozens and dozens of deaths of our first line responders to the COVID-19 virus. I would encourage all the commissioners to observe a virtual candlelight ceremony tomorrow evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll provide you with a link to the ceremony in our reminder email that will go out this evening. At this time, I'd ask our Executive Director, Dean Keeter, to conduct a roll call of commissioners.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before I call the roll, I'd once again like to remind everyone that today's event is open to the press. And for any members of the media on the call, if you have questions or need clarification on anything, please contact Christina Mastropasqua in the Justice Department's Public Affairs Office. And with that, I will begin the roll call. Commissioner Bowditch.
I'm here.
Commissioner Clemens.
Here.
Commissioner Evans.
Here.
Commissioner Frazier. Commissioner Galtieri.
I'm here.
Commissioner Hawkins.
Present, thank you.
Commissioner Lombardo.
Here, thank you, Dean.
Commissioner McDonald.
Here.
Commissioner Moody.
Here, on the line.
Commissioner Parr.
I'm here.
Commissioner Price.
Good afternoon, I'm here.
Commissioner Ramsey.
Here.
Commissioner Rausch.
I'm here.
Commissioner Samaniego.
I'm here.
Commissioner Smallwood. Vice Chair Sullivan.
Hi, I'm here.
And Commissioner Washington.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes the roll call.
Thank you. Any other announcements, Dean? Any other announcements, Dean?
No, sir. We're good to go.
Thank you. All commissioners should have the bios and some of the testimony for this panel, and as a reminder, we'll be posting all these materials on the Law Enforcement Commission website. Once again, we continue to acknowledge everyone's commitment, efforts, and contributions to meet the goals of this historic commission. On behalf of General Barr, we thank each of you. As noted on previous calls, we encourage commissioners to take notes during the testimony of the panelists, and we will then open for questions from commissioners after the last witness. Our first distinguished panelist is Dr. Charlie Shear, who is Assistant Professor from the University of Southern Mississippi. Not only is Dr. Shiro a published researcher on police workforce management, police training, and organizational development, he's also a sworn sheriff's deputy. Dr. Shiro, thank you for joining us today. You're recognized.
Thank you, sir. Once again, my name is Charlie Shear from the University of Southern Mississippi, and the project that I'm going to talk briefly about today is actually started from the marketing and business realms, a little different than social science research usually is. It came about through conversations with Chief Leonard Pepena from Gulfport, Mississippi Police Department. This is a department that was heavily affected by Hurricane Katrina. And a partner on this was Mike Rossler from Illinois State. The origin of this project was there's a lack of research about what applicants want from the career, what they expect from an agency that would want to hire them. And a sub-question that we were interested in this project is what may draw them towards policing and what may potentially push them away or be a barrier to their interest. So we conducted a survey of 5 universities' students, and those universities are listed on the report that you're provided with, and there were 100 items on the survey. Briefly, the descriptive statistics show us several points of information that are interesting and were very unexpected. The first is that these respondents are curious and interested in police work. About 40% show some interest, and they display a curiosity about things like promotional potential and the aspects of the helping profession that policing is. They are interested in the job. They're also very motivated in this interest. We were fishing for something in this project. We looked at the rigorous hiring process, the scrutiny of the selection process, including their social media scrutiny, the academy length and intensity, potential for hard physical training, a change in lifestyle associated with police work, family and friends pressuring them, and personal history issues. None of these things were found to be well-established barriers from just the basic descriptive statistics. They do influence their concept of going into police work, but they're not deal breakers, which is kind of important to think about. These folks who answered the survey also see a disconnect between police departments and their recruiting practices that they're exposed to, and what they expect from not only the career and the lifestyle, but what they expect to see from a recruitment standpoint. They desire more mentoring and career preview, not just information about the selection criteria, but an immersion in police work from the beginning of their interest, which is very intriguing. It was an unexpected finding. They have curiosity and expectations about the career ladder that even they admit may be unrealistic somewhat, but they don't believe they're getting proper information about these promotional opportunities. For instance, we asked a question, would you be interested in becoming a sergeant? The same percentage said, yes, I would, as said they don't know what a sergeant specifically does. So that told us a lot. We did some additional statistical modeling with this sample, and especially taking African-American respondents and women out of the sample, and we found a number of talking points that I'd like to present. The first is that there's sustained interest in the face of multiple potential barriers, but the work needs to be done to reach these people. They want to know more, and I highlight a question that we asked about their generation expecting not to pay their dues before they obtain success in a career field. Well, that's something that we could all agree. It may be consistent across generations, but interestingly enough, it raised the possibility that we're not telling them what they're going to get from paying their dues. We're not allowing them to see the rewards of paying their dues, especially what paying their dues might even entail in a police department. The second talking point is there are opportunities for sincere, transparent relationship building, and I use the metaphor of a football coach recruiter type. And this comes about in some of the concerns of the African-American respondents as it pertains to peer, friend, and family support, and women's concerns about barriers to promotion and police culture. And this implies a targeted, personal, sort of one-to-one recruiting realism that we, you know, as I'd say, the football coach recruiter style, somebody who's willing to make a personal identification with that person. The third talking point that comes up is, it's a cool career, so let's show them this. including the realities of physical confrontation, which they are curious about and want to know more information in order to sort of dispel myths that may exist. And this raises the possibility of things like ride-alongs, meaningful internships, and opportunities to really see the department that we wish departments were doing across the board, and we know that that's not the case universally. A fourth talking point would be these people were attracted to the helping mission within the context of blue-collar professions. They're interested in knowing about job security and benefits. This is a wide-open opportunity for mentoring, from Zillow to Apartment Finder to Trulia to exploring the benefits to overtime. They've never been down this path that they're about to embark on called adulthood, and we can really show them the interplay of career rewards and benefits and brand our agencies in the process. A fifth talking point is be wary of a potential target candidate. There are a lot of people in these responses, as you can look through, that are on the margins of interest, and if police recruiters could influence family and peer group and significant others, they may be able to nudge these curious people with a concerted recruitment strategy. Wanted to finish up by asking, is your agency a great place to work? Because that's what these young people are looking for. I've personally seen them pass up salary to work for certain people who they perceived as being charismatic and committed to the same things they wanted out of life. And I'd like you to imagine a person who from a young age is curious about the police. You know, they may have dressed up as a cop as Halloween costume. All their life there's been this mystique about the police. They've really been into the idea. They'll do what it takes to make this happen. They've reached that point, and they finally are able to talk to somebody who's doing that, and they have no opportunity to see it up close. They're told to go on a website, no ride-alongs, or the wrong person is the public face of that department. Make your agency the one that opens the door because you're as enthusiastic about the career as they are, and I think you can probably make a recruit out of these folks. And that's my testimony.
Thank you, Dr. Scheer, for your valued testimony and certainly your service. Next, we have a distinguished and very well-known chief with us today, Chief Will Johnson from Arlington, Texas Police Department. Chief Johnson has over two decades of law enforcement experience and is also on the board of the International Association of Chiefs of Police and the Major City Chiefs Association, as well as an executive fellow with the Police Executive Research Forum. Chief Johnson, thank you for joining us today. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Keith, Vice Chair Sullivan, and esteemed commissioners. It's my great honor to be able to be before you virtually to testify on this very important topic. For my colleagues and friends for many years serving as commissioners, thank you for your service and your commitment. And for those of you that I haven't had the privilege to meet, I look forward to being able to do so at the future, and thank you for your commitment. I know how difficult it has been serving as a commissioner during these trying times with COVID. As I talk about the challenges of recruitment, it's certainly a perspective that is shared by many in IACP and Major City Chiefs. IACP membership survey revealed that 65% of agencies reported of having too few candidates apply for law enforcement positions. This is slightly different than the 78% that responded saying that they had difficulty recruiting qualified candidates. So both the volume is low and the quality within the volume is low. 75% of agencies reported that recruiting is much more difficult today than it was even a mere 5 years ago. And sadly, in this survey, 50% of the responding agencies indicated that they had to modify or adapt their departmental policies in order to meet the changing dynamics that they were having with staffing shortages, and 25% had to reduce or eliminate certain agency services because of inadequate staffing levels. And so the three main driving factors that I think most people would agree that are influencing the challenges in recruiting are generational differences. Now, that's not to say that one generation is better than the other or one generation is deficient than the other. It's just simply saying that as different generations emerge into the workforce, that they have different priorities, different needs, and policing, being a hyper-traditionalist sort of organization, has not done well in managing with those changes. The hiring process itself is daunting, and frankly, it takes too long. Many agencies are confronted with 6 months, 9 months, or a year or more before they can navigate a candidate through the hiring process to be able to join the organization, in which time that candidate is at risk of being lost to other organizations and or to other sectors. And then, frankly, there's a public image challenge with law enforcement today. Many of those who have served certainly know the nobility of policing and have given most of their adult life to that cause, but that's not always what is reported or conveyed to the community, and it creates a challenge whenever recruiting new individuals into the workforce. And so I'd like to offer several recommendations for the commission to consider. Certainly it's not an exhaustive list, but I think that it represents the high points of some of the greatest opportunities that we have for success in moving forward. We need to create opportunities for youth to gain experience and credit towards police employment. And this can be done through a variety of federal programs that create an umbrella of emphasis for state and local agencies to participate within and have shared experiences. But very specifically, I think there's an opportunity to expand the COPS hiring grant process to include paid police cadets, where departments can recruit younger employees, give them exposure within the department, give them one-on-one mentorship as junior employees within the organization with the aspirational hope of transitioning to law enforcement status. I think that more can be done to work with the Department of Education to promote partnerships with law enforcement, with colleges and universities on a macro level to allow police recruits to trade their training hours for college credits. And these types of programs will give recruits an opportunity to not only build upon their emerging career in policing, but to also complement that career with formalized education at the university setting. There is a real opportunity to expand and simplify loan forgiveness programs offered to police under the Department of Education Temporary Expanded Public Service Loan Forgiveness Act. This is an underutilized program that, quite frankly, if you ask just the rank and file officer or the college applicant, many individuals don't know that the program even exists, and those that do have an extreme difficulty navigating the bureaucracy to qualify for reimbursement. To promote education collaborative partnerships, develop federal programs to incentivize colleges and universities that receive federal funds to develop programs within their universities to reduce barriers for students to enter public service. Many employees, certainly it's no different in Arlington, that are first-generation college-educated employees have a profound sense of duty to give back to the neighborhoods in which they came from. And by working with the educational system and the public system with police departments, I believe that we can expand and reduce those barriers for those students. The same would hold true with the Department of Defense to expand formalized partnerships with the military, where universal service credits can be received for our servicemen and women for some of the training and experiences that they have in the military to give them a competitive advantage when they reenter society through public service. Certainly not all military service has a direct correlation with local law enforcement or policing, but many of their training experiences and job assignments do, and we should leverage that to reduce barriers for service personnel to join policing. I think there's a clear opportunity for a national recruitment campaign. This national campaign and advertising marketing campaign could help address some of the public stigma for policing and help share on a national basis what the true mission is and the true day-to-day activities of a police officer are. I believe that many people, and I think even the previous testimony would support, that there is an intrinsic desire to give back to the community. And people are drawn into the profession whenever you activate that sense of duty and that sense of compassion where people can give back to their communities, but yet oftentimes the marketing of such is inadequate, and whatever marketing is present is certainly one of the first items to be eliminated in budget reductions. And then I would just kind of wrap up talking about budget reductions, that recruiting in policing was extraordinarily challenged before COVID-19. I'm fearful that it will be next to impossible as we enter into the economic consequences of COVID-19, and as municipalities and states try to balance their budgets, many times training, recruiting, advertising are all activities that are first to go within the budget. And so I would offer three principled approaches for law enforcement to remain important in the post-COVID conversation. First, that we should really maximize the grant funding that is available for law enforcement, specifically that it's direct funding to agencies and not block funding in which could be diverted to other non-law enforcement needs. Secondarily, this funding needs to remain as flexible as possible because each community has their own unique challenges as they're dealing with these consequences. And third, that they advocate for the elimination of the artificial population count in the CARES Funding Act. I don't care if you're a two-man department, a 1,000-employee department like mine, or 35,000 like New York. Every community is challenged in recruiting. And being able to leverage those grant dollars in the most direct, meaningful way is going to be important as we move forward. Thank you for the opportunity to provide this testimony. This concludes my verbal remarks.
Thank you, Chief Johnson, for your valued testimony and certainly for your dedicated service. Our next panelist is another distinguished law enforcement professional. Deputy Chief Valerie Cunningham from the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. Chief Cunningham has over 30 years of law enforcement experience, and she's been a valued partner to both the COPS Office and the Bureau of Justice Assistance. We're happy to have her join us today. Chief Cunningham, you're recognized.
Thank you, Director Keith, and thank you, Commissioners, for your time today. I'm very pleased to be here today to talk to you specifically about recruitment strategies to attract female applicants. This is an easy conversation for me to have with you here today because my agency has had some success in that in the recent past. IMPD, the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, is not unlike most major city police departments in that our sworn workforce is approximately 13% female. In fact, that 13% percentile of females on the agency has been around for about the last two decades as kind of a ceiling where females have been in law enforcement, although we make up, as you know, 50 to 51% of the population. And currently, trends show that we're actually decreasing. As we talk about women in this profession, it's important to remember that we haven't been on the front lines as long as our male counterparts. In fact, just over 50 years ago, in 1968, the first women were assigned to patrol duties. And I'm very proud to say that that occurred in Indianapolis, Indiana, when officers Elizabeth Robinson and Betty Blankenship hit the streets in September of 1968. In the decades that have passed since then, women have proven that they can not only do this job and excel, but that our communities and our profession are better served by the unique and complementary skill sets that they bring to the table. There's no doubt that increased representation by women and minorities at all levels affects the culture within law enforcement agencies, a culture that we need to take a realistic look at to examine the barriers that are either perceived or real that exist that discourage women and minorities from applying to this profession. Biases that are either explicit or implicit must be aggressively rooted out of all agencies. And leadership must be cognizant that they exist. They need to identify and address them. Today, I'm going to share with you some of the recruitment successes that the Indianapolis Police Department has had to increase the number of female applicants and, in turn, the number of females entering into our academy and joining our agency. This past December, Our 20th recruit class was made up of 31% females. We made changes in our recruitment strategies that began in late 2016. And every year since then, the percentage of females entering into our academy has been higher than the national average. I do hesitate, though, to share these tactics as specifically focused toward women or minorities. We changed our overall recruitment strategy to look for highly qualified, motivated, and committed individuals with the mindset that this profession requires an individual that is called to service. We don't look at any applicant as a number or a checkbox. As a matter of fact, we often talk about looking beyond diversity and talking about the culture within our agency being an inclusive one where everyone is welcome. Fighting the lower number of applicants nationwide, as you've just heard, we focus on the quality of our interaction with every applicant that shows interest. I am going to present and highlight a couple of the programs that were in my written testimony that I believe are foundational cornerstones for where agencies can start. My recommendations I'm going to present now and at the end again as a reminder, but my recommendations and takeaways for this for agencies are to focus on marketing campaigns that are inclusive of females. As a matter of fact, in the past 2 years, all of Indianapolis's marketing campaigns as far as billboards, bus boards, and bench boards have focused on one of our programs, Women Behind the Badge, and they've all been photographs of women only in uniform. The second recommendation is to tailor all the contact that an agency has with their applicant so that it's mutually beneficial to both the agency and the applicant. Applicants want to understand what they are going to be asked to do, what they are committing to, and what that's going to look like for them as an individual. If you use tactics such as ride-alongs or introducing them into internship programs, ensure that there's oversight to make sure that they have quality engagement at each of those levels. If they're riding with an officer, make sure that officer is open to discussing to give that applicant a preview into what it would look like if they were in this career. The third one is focus on that preview of what the career would look like for that individual. Talk about the organizational culture. Talk about the resources available within the profession and have transparent, open conversations. One of the highlights of our recruiting efforts are we engage our candidates in community forums where they sit in the audience and we have academics, community stakeholders, and executives from our agency have a moderator to discuss current incidents that have occurred or issues within law enforcement and national narratives that may be anti-law enforcement, and have those open discussions in that classroom. And fourth, and the key to all of this, is to develop a meaningful relationship, professional relationship with these applicants that occurs through reoccurring contact. And this leads me into talking about our PAR program, PAR, which stands for Pre-Academy Readiness. We look at every applicant and we try to remove any perceived obstacles that they may have of coming onto the agency. For women specifically, physical testing has always been a barrier. Indiana still has very archaic standards. They are focused on strength, particularly upper body strength. And over the years, we've shown a disparate impact in one of our standards, which is a requirement that a female must do 22 military planked out push-ups. A male must do the same to enter into the academy. Should a female only do 21, they are not accepted in our process, and they are out of the process for the next 2 years because of one push-up. It's a physiological fact that women are 70% as strong as men in the upper body. A female can do 22 push-ups. The encouragement we do through the Pre-Academy Readiness Program is making them understand that even if they start at zero, they can get to 22. It just takes time and commitment. The disparate impact we've had in the past is the fact that people do not sincerely look at that number 22 as a challenge and think that it's something that can be accomplished in 30 days, having never done a push-up. We educate them, encourage them, and train them over the course of months to get them to that standard. for success. We practice physical skills to get a comfort level with the testing, which is very important for females who tend to be less confident. There's an informal atmosphere created. I myself, having oversight of the academy and the recruiting, I participate in the workouts. Our pre-academy readiness is held every Tuesday evening at the same time for 1 hour, and we're very respectful of people's time in that 1 hour. I put on workout clothes, I mix in with the group, and it's an informal atmosphere where they can ask questions, garner information, and again, preview and get a snapshot of not only our culture on our agency, but an understanding about what's going on with the recruiting process, what's going on with the hiring process, what will be going on in the academy. It's also an opportunity for us to assess the applicant's suitability, their performance, and an opportunity to lay down the building blocks to enhance resiliency, which is, in my opinion, the most important trait an officer can have for survival. That includes for their own mental resiliency, but their physical wellness as well. We also set the expectations in this pre-academy readiness that it's not a competition, that it's built for confidence, and the only thing you need to bring is a good attitude and 100% willingness to exert your best effort. We also invite formal mentors, field training officers, academy staff, and our wellness unit to join in these workouts with the applicants. The relationships that we've built through PAR form internal networking relationships amongst each other and the applicants that carry into the academy then and already establish a support system for them. The other program that I would like to highlight is our Women Behind the Badge program. That is a workshop. The workshop is females only, and again, it goes to giving them a preview of what it would be like for an officer. And for females specifically, it addresses some of the concerns that they come in with, which is shift work, childcare, family dynamics, support from community, the culture that they're entering into, being a male-dominated culture, and how they're going to fit in. They're all candid conversations that are had there. The good news in all of these programs is we just heard that budgets are probably going to be reduced. None of these programs cost a lot of money. It all involves commitment of time. And as someone, as I've always heard, the most valuable gift you can give someone is your time. And again, the recommendations are to be your marketing efforts to be inclusive of females, to tailor all contacts with the applicant so it's mutually beneficial, to make sure you provide previews of what being an officer would be like, highlight your organizational culture, and develop relationships with your applicant through transparent conversations and clear expectations. And that is my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Cunningham, for your testimony and for your valuable contribution to law enforcement and certainly your service. Our last panelist today is retired Lansing, Michigan Chief of Police Mike Yankowski. He is also the Assistant Director of the Institutional Ethics and Compliance at the Michigan State University. Chief Yankowski modeled his career around five key areas, including building police and community trust, recruiting and hiring a diverse department, reducing violent crime, increasing training and officer wellness, and strengthening policy and accountability. Chief Yankowski, thank you for joining us today. You're recognized.
Thank you. I want to start off by saying good afternoon to the commissioners, and thank you for serving on this important presidential commission. As it was stated, my name is Mike Yankowski. I retired from the Lansing Police Department in 2009. Lansing Police Department is located in Lansing, Michigan, and my currently Chapter 2 career is in ethics and compliance as the Assistant Director at Michigan State University. I want to first start out by really saying that one of the most important responsibilities of a law enforcement executive is to hire the best possible police officers you can. In the city of Lansing, which was the capital city of Michigan, sixth largest in the state of Michigan, population is about 120,000. A diverse urban city, the Lansing Police Department has been providing policing service for 125 years. It had 203 sworn police officers. So it's one of the largest police departments in the state of Michigan, but it's really considered a medium-sized agency, so you can relate to other agencies during this review. No doubt you're hearing a similar theme here today, and I want to highlight this because Chief Johnson had mentioned it earlier. You know, the city of Lansing was not immune to the Great Recession from about 2006 to 2012. Downsizing of city government led to reductions of almost 40% of our personnel. Lansing Police Department didn't hire one police officer for almost 5 years. When we were finally given that green light to go ahead, we opened up the valves, and that water just wasn't really coming out. It was a trickle, and it was rusty. And the fact is that a lot had changed in the world of police hiring during the Great Recession. Not only did the candidates' viewpoints on public safety change, so had the playing conditions. And so when we talk about, it's almost like deja vu, potentially, that with the COVID-19, the funding sources and all the best practices, lessons learned, we cannot repeat the same mistakes. So in 2013, when I took over as the chief of police, recruiting and hiring was not going to be on my first task of things. But after two really, really poor showings in police hiring, we knew that we needed to change our playbook. And that's exactly what we did. As with anything, it starts with leadership. You got to have the commitment from the top down. But what we tried to do is develop a 21st century policing hiring playbook. And the foundation of what we based our model on was to really create a farm system with our youth and by building one-on-one personal relationships. You heard Dr. Shear talk about it a little bit. Same philosophy. I was a college athlete, and when I remember getting recruited to play football, that's exactly what it was. It was a recruitment. So we kind of took the approach of, what would it take to recruit high school athletes, you know, to our university and replicate that in policing? So the Lansing model, I'm going to combine these as recommendations as well, is really around seven principles. Starts out, again, with hiring candidates to reflect the values and the vision of the department. Listen, we're in the business of service, and we got to have people that are highly ethical, good moral character, good communication, that community policing mindset. You can't make the mistake of just hiring a warm body to fill that vacancy. We took that to the next level of growing your own talent. Just like you do in baseball, you have a farm system. You got to create pipelines, and we try to focus within a 90-mile radius. We had some youth programs, our Explorer program, our Cadet program, our Youth Academy, the gang resistance education and training. We had 10 officers going to the middle schools and teach our youngsters about, you know, making good decisions, but building rapport along the way. High school career centers and police athletic leagues all came into play in building that farm system. So an Explorer program, I'm just going to take a minute to speak on an Explorer program, is really it's focusing on young adults between the ages of 14 and 21. They volunteer, they're not paid, but we teach them skill sets and really introduce them to the profession of law enforcement, but they also get out into the community and community events. And so we're kind of mentoring them at a younger age, trying to get them engaged into career centers and just kind of coaxing them along. Because of that program, you know, we were getting 35 kids a year signing up for that, and it's really, really helped us move our recruiting program to the next level, which would then be our cadet program, where they're sponsored, they're paid a salary, and again, that mentorship continues. And again, I think the key there is that you're really establishing a one-on-one relationship, and it starts at the top. As the chief of police, I'd be the one making phone calls. I'd be texting individuals. Anytime there was a job offer, they were getting the phone call from the police chief. I sat in on every single police officer interview. And I think that's very important because you're establishing that it's important that you are investing time and money into someone because you want them to represent who you are. You talk about that investment. It doesn't just start and end with financial resources. It's a big part of what you need to stay committed to that, but it's the time commitment. And so when you talk about investing in your people, which we all do, invest in people, it's not just about time and money. You're committing to your values as an organization, why you want them to come work for you. So again, recruitment is more than just handing out flyers and attending recruiting fairs. It's about establishing that one-on-one relationship. And I will tell you, when you talk about establishing a relationship, it's not just with the candidate. It's also with their family as well. We make house visits. We have conversations. We meet with parents. We meet with significant others just to kind of build that rapport with the entire family because it's a big commitment for someone to go into law enforcement. What it also does is you create community champions along the way. We have community members sitting in our police officer interviews, and I can tell you, you want to build some capital and some trust with your community, include them in your recruiting process, include them in your interview process, and they will go out and bring you candidates. Branding is a very important thing as well because you want the candidates, they see something in your department. They like what they see. They like what they hear. We always try to have a branding strategy. At the Lansing Police Department, it was very simple for us. Come join to be one of the capital city's finest. You heard others talk about streamlining the hiring process, and I can tell you that it was one of our major obstacles. It was taking us 9 months to a year to hire individuals. That's way too long. The two most common complaints was it takes too long and lack of communication. So emphasizing that time to hire, and we were getting our processes done in 90 days or less. And just kind of closing, I think it's, to sum up what our philosophy was to really engage in our youth at a younger age, embrace them into this service-oriented profession, get them to see our police officers as role models, and then to also continue that process throughout their entire career. You heard Dr. Shear talk about it. They like to see a good police-community relations. They want opportunities. It's not always about the dollar. And so we owe it to them to continue that professional development and training once we get them inside our doors because it's really a family atmosphere. And I can tell you, with the Lansing Police Department, we saw this strategy help our minority hiring tremendously. My first couple recruiting classes were less than 5% in minority hiring. Our last recruiting class had over 60% minority females. So we saw great examples of how we can move from the next level to the next one. So that will complete my testimony.
Thank you, Chief Kowski, for your valued testimony and for your service to law enforcement. Commissioners, we are now open for questions for the witnesses. Commissioners, with a question, please state your name prior to your question and direct the question to a specific panelist or the entire panel. Just as a reminder to the commissioners, your mics are hot at all times. Thank you, and with that, we'll open for questions from commissioners or our panelists.
President Keith, this is Commissioner Lombardo with ATF. I have a question.
Yes, ma'am, you're recognized.
Thank you. I first want to say thank you for all the panel members who took the time to put together great products, good quality testimony. Will, out there, I think we've spoken in the past about your department and some of your hurdles and some of the good advice that you've given us. So I guess specifically my question would probably be to Deputy Chief Valerie Cunningham. Let me just preface it by saying first, we at ATF do have our struggles with recruiting, female agents especially. We're not unique to any other law enforcement organization, state, local, but federal government. We also have our challenges as we average in the Department of Justice about 11%, 12% as the average. So we've been pretty focused on proper recruitment and really have been staying focused on that with our campaign of hashtag She's ATF, and I think a lot of that is paying off. But I guess my question is, I heard testimony previously about your wellness program in your police department, and do you use that and highlight that in your recruitment efforts? And that's one question, and the other would be, is there one in particular thing that you would say is sort of the must-dos? Is there anything in particular that sticks out that was your the best advice, the most, highly recommend you have to do in order to really make a difference in proper recruitment, especially for female? For us, that is our biggest challenge.
Thank you, Director. So we do highlight our wellness program. The wellness program is also in the division that is underneath my responsibility. That program, one of the sergeants assigned to it has a background and degree in exercise physiology, as do I. So we participate in the physical activities at this PAR program. So we introduce it through physical wellness, talking about that, talking about diet, talking about essentially physical wellness. And then as the walls and the barriers break down and that informal relationship fosters with the applicants, we go into talking about the mental wellness components and resources that our agency offers. We also introduce them to the mentoring program, which is through our wellness office, and that's where we bring in some of those mentors that participate in that formalized program to be introduced to the applicants, because what we do here in Indianapolis is we assign a formal mentor day one of the academy. So we introduce our wellness office through the PAR program, that pre-academy readiness. And the one thing that has really helped us with the female applicants is that women behind the badge workshop. It's attended by almost 85% of the females that we have in an application process. It's a voluntary attendance. It's a full-day program. And we bring in officers on our agency. I firmly believe that you have to see it to believe that you can become it. So we bring them in at all different levels, and we let them ask questions. And most of the questions center around, Dr. Shear hit it right on the point, they want a preview of what it's like. For females in particular, I think they have additional challenges at home. In society, they're typically the ones that are responsible for taking care of the children, keeping the house up, all additional responsibilities, and they want to know how that's going to work if they want to do this profession. They ask some very specific, very pointed questions. A lot of them are around family dynamics. A lot of them are around support that they will get, or that they feel that they're going to lack in their environments and relationships that they currently have because of their gender entering into a male-dominated profession. But just the atmosphere to allow them to openly ask questions about that. One of the biggest questions we have a lot, because of the age of our applicants, we have a lot of brand-new mothers. And some of the questions are around facilities that we have to allow them to pump breast milk while they're on duty, how that's perceived. Is it, are they going to be ostracized when they do something like that? Will they be looked at as being weak? But that, by far, the one thing that I think stands out is having a forum and an opportunity for them to interact with people already doing the job to ask very relevant questions for what it's going to be like for them if they choose to commit. Thank you.
I appreciate the guidance there. I'll look a little bit more into that. Maybe craft something similar. Again, that is not so much, I think it's also part of our retention program issues as well, is coming on young before they create a life and have other responsibilities and children and all sorts of other obstacles that we're trying to sort of remove some of the roadblocks, and it helps with not just the recruitment but retention. So thank you for that recommendation. I appreciate that.
Other commissioners with questions?
Mr. Keith?
Yes, sir, you're recognized.
This is Craig Price, South Dakota. Again, appreciate everybody's excellent testimony today, and I sat here and listened and took copious amount of notes just because there's so many good ideas that come from you. I do have a question for Dr. Scheer in regards to marketing, advertising, and recruiting, and whether or not that has an impact on retention. And the specific question I have is, when agencies advertise, you know, it's common for us, I think, to advertise the highlights of what we do, specifically SWAT team members, canine officers, aircraft pilots, DREs, all of the niche type of things that really require a high level of specialty that oftentimes aren't achieved until several years of employment. Is there any data that you're aware of that shows an impact on, and I know this isn't about retention, but I think it somewhat has a connection. Is there any data that demonstrates that using those types of recruiting efforts has a negative or neutral impact on retention for those officers that maybe don't achieve those things that they had hoped to when they first saw the marketing campaign and having contact with an agency?
Sir, that's a great question. This is Charlie Shear. We do not have, to my knowledge, and we are embarking, the folks that have been working on this recruitment project, we are embarking on a project related to retention this year. We expect to have some first preliminary results of that. What we are trying to do just quickly is we're talking to people who have left and people who are staying, and both from agencies that were both have happened, but also surveying those who are at existing agencies and talking to leavers. And then we're going to be doing a series of roundtable discussions with folks from a select number of agencies in a way that, in an effort to ascertain what are the things that are potentially keeping people where they are and things that may act as the forces of pushing people away or having people leave. So the short answer is I'm not aware of anything of that nature. However, if you think about recruiting research in a very small field, and specifically market research that's done with advertising, it seems to me that we'd be interested in finding out about organizational commitment. That's a phenomenon that comes about in psychology where it's basically, I think this place cares about me. And we haven't really done a whole lot of research yet into whether or not police officers feel as though the place they work has got their back. And I'd like to know more about that. I think that there is a lot of research that can be done to sort of get at whether or not people who are existing police officers, how long have they been at that agency? Are they actively looking for another place to work right now? Have they considered it? Why? Those are the questions that we don't have answers to, but I'd like to know. We are going to be starting a project this year. Like I said, we hope to have some preliminary results in the fall. I have indicated to everybody my contact information, so we'd like to be able to get that information out to you if you want to keep in contact with me.
Yeah, that sounds very good. I'll have your information, and I think I'll do that. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Other commissioners with questions?
Chairman Keith, this is
Other commissioner. Commissioner, you've recognized.
Thank you. Really to any of the panels, but maybe Chief Johnson may have some insight. But I'm curious in terms of, you had mentioned overcoming the narrative about law enforcement. What are some of the ways that we might be able to address that as we continue to try to fight that narrative and it seems to never go away? How do we combat that?
Thank you, Commissioner Will Johnson. You know, I think that the answers to that question really lie outside of policing, and it would be beneficial for the commissioners to maybe get expert in marketing to share their perspective. But I because Arlington is such a sports-driven community, and I've had a chance to see some of the advertising that surrounds just the sporting profession. The fact of the matter is we are not structured in the United States with our decentralized, locally controlled police department, which absolutely fits the constitutional principles in which we all hope and want for policing, to be able to address corporate communications on a profession level because of that decentralization. And so because everybody is doing all that they can and all the resources that they have available to try to put the best, project the best nobility of their police department, you know, we're as we say in Texas, you know, we're an inch deep and a mile wide, right, where we really need to have a greater degree of penetration that can only come from a structured, nationalized initiative directed towards public education and informing the American society about the true nature of policing. Because, frankly, there's so many competing voices out there, everything from Hollywood to just the small aspect of a police officer's work that actually makes the nightly news, that forms people's opinion about what policing is. And much like some of the other panelists testified, that some of today's recruits, particularly women in policing, they want to hear a more in-depth explanation and have information that's beyond just that high-level exposure. Most people form their belief of policing based on that high-level information that is vastly underappreciative of the day-in and day-out work that police officers do serve in the community.
Thank you.
Other commissioners with questions?
Mr. Chair, this is Commissioner Smallwood. I don't have a question, but I did want to let you know I was a little late getting in the room, but I am here.
Yes, sir, and the record reflects that. Thank you, Commissioner. Hearing no further questions, let me close by thanking our panelists once again for your time and most valuable testimony and the responses to questions from the commissioners. On behalf of the Attorney General and his leadership team of Rachel Bissick and Jeff Avita and all the commissioners, your contributions provided today are most sincerely appreciated and will assist the commission in their deliberations and work. Before we close, just a reminder that our next two hearings this week will be on Wednesday and Thursday. Also, please check the President's Commission page for additional updates of documents and information on the Main Justice website. We'll update it regularly when information is made available for posting. We want to thank the FBI for their continued support by providing their teleconference network to the Commission, and certainly all the federal program managers working diligently behind the scenes to support the efforts of the Commission and the working groups. Are there any questions or comments from commissioners?
Nope.
If there's no further business before us today, the President's Commission is adjourned. Thank you, commissioners, for your continued dedication and commitment.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. This concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.
Thank you.